It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new book pairs antique postcards from Chippewa Falls with pictures taken at exactly the same spots today. We'll talk to the photographer about his unique look at a Wisconsin community, past and present. First, for over a year, AT&T has been in talks with CNN's parent company Time Warner about a merger, and President Trump's Department of Justice wants to block the $85 billion deal. It would be one of the largest acquisitions in American history, but it isn't unheard of. Back in 2011, the Obama administration approved a merger between Comcast and NBC Universal, which was also a giant partnership between a content creator and a media distributor. So why is the Trump administration taking issue with the merger? There are a couple of theories, and Derek Thompson wrote about them for The Atlantic. He's a senior editor there, and he writes about economics, labor markets, and the media. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
What was the Department of Justice's stated reason for not wanting this merger to go forward?
Well, you said there are two different narratives here. The first narrative says that this is all about Donald Trump trying to punish CNN, which is owned by Time Warner. So there's some people who say essentially, look, Trump said a year ago that he was going to block this merger for the purpose of punishing CNN, and indeed now the Justice Department is blocking the merger, so clearly they're just doing the bidding of Donald Trump. But there's another theory that says, no, maybe this is just good antitrust enforcement. Now, what complicates the second story, as you also said, is that, hey, didn't the Justice Department just approve a really similar deal very recently between Comcast, a media distributor, and NBC Universal, a media company, a media content creator? And the answer to that is that the new antitrust head of the Justice Department, a guy named Makan Del Rahim, has essentially said that the decision to allow the Comcast-NBCU merger was a mistake, because they essentially said, all right, you can merge, but there's going to be behavioral conditions. You can't do certain anti-competitive things that somehow, say, raise prices for other companies or limit video entertainment innovation. And Del Rahim is essentially saying, look, rather than allow large companies to merge and then have to babysit them to make sure that they don't do inevitably anti-competitive things, let's just not allow those mergers in the first place. Isn't that the better antitrust regulation, which actually cuts down on the need for the Justice Department to regulate and babysit for the next few years? So I think you can very easily say, and I've actually talked to several legal experts who have concurred, that what you're seeing here might have nothing at all to do with story number one and Donald Trump. It might have everything to do with wise antitrust enforcement.
And let's talk about the two companies involved here. Time Warner, we mentioned they own CNN. They own a lot of stuff. This is a big content creation company.
Yes, absolutely. They own, I mean, if you have turned on your television, your pay TV at some point in the last week, you have probably seen content that is owned by Time Warner. They own Turner Broadcasting, that's TNT, that's CNN, that's TBS. So if you've seen like a basketball game, a baseball game sometime in the last year, you have very likely seen Turner content. And then also they own HBO. And so there might be lots of people listening who don't have television but do have, or pay TV, but do have an HBO Now over-the-top subscription to HBO. So once again, they're watching Time Warner there too. This is an enormous media company, one of the largest media companies in the U.S., one of the most storied media companies in the U.S. But we're in a period right now where television, which for many decades was the king of entertainment, pay TV is now feeling a little bit endangered. If you look at pay TV viewing hours for people under the age of 35, you find that they have declined by about 50% in the last 7 years. And that's because a lot of these younger viewers are moving on to internet television. They're watching Netflix, they're watching Amazon Prime, they're watching Hulu. And as a result, Time Warner isn't getting the sort of income that it was expecting 7 years ago. And that's one of the reasons why you now see mergers all over the place in media, Comcast and NBC, AT&T and Time Warner, even AT&T and DirecTV. The old media, the legacy media companies, are really feeling the chill from big tech right now. And in order to stay safe, they are banding together. They're finding their strength in numbers. And the Justice Department essentially saying, no, you cannot create oligopolistic companies just to compete with big tech.
Talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic, looking at this potential Time Warner AT&T deal and the Department of Justice saying, nope, we want to block this thing. Derek, when people think of monopolies, sometimes they might think of people people in the same industry, if Ford and GM merged about or something like that. In this case, the worry about anti-competitive behavior might be, okay, hey, look, we're making HBO and we're making the platform you're all watching it on, or if you use AT&T, you're watching it on, we can give AT&T a leg up by getting some kind of exclusive deal for, I don't know, Game of Thrones or something like that.
Yes, you're talking about monopoly economics, and this is a really important point. There's a difference between vertical mergers and horizontal mergers. Let's take the example of something like shoes, for example. Shoes. A vertical merger would be a shoe leather company merging with a shoe distribution company or a shoe store. That is considered a vertical merger because there are different parts in the production cycle, and vertical mergers for the last four decades have typically been considered kosher. The Justice Department has typically said, A-OK, you can do it. What tends to be bad is when all the shoe leather manufacturers band together, so now there's just one company that makes shoe leather, and as a result, it can basically dictate prices to the entire market. Those are horizontal mergers, and those tend to be declined or sued or rejected by the Justice Department, precisely because you can imagine how that monopoly would work. It would dictate the entire market, push prices up, and punish consumers. But what the Justice Department is saying here is kind of interesting. They're saying, yes, we understand that this is a vertical merger. We understand that for the last four decades, the Justice Department has typically allowed such vertical mergers. But we think that the way the Justice Department has been thinking about these sort of mergers has been flawed. Because what we've been doing is allowing companies like Comcast and NBC Universal to get together and then said, look, we know that there are temptations for you guys to be anti-competitive, say, forcing other companies to spend more money on NBC content and then charging yourself less for that NBC content. We know that there are temptations to do this, but we're going to babysit you for the next decade, two decades, to make sure that you don't give in to that temptation. And what Del Rahim is saying, what the guy at Trump's DOJ is saying, head of antitrust, is why are we giving ourselves this homework? Why are we forcing the DOJ to have all this regulatory burden in order to babysit these companies that we know are going to try to go behind our backs and be anti-competitive? Let's just block the vertical merger in the first place so that we don't have to pile regulation upon regulation on oversight. And that, I think, again, is the sort of argument that, yes, is a departure from the recent past, but is also a self-contained, clean, and logical argument that doesn't require conspiracy theories that say this is all about Donald Trump hating CNN.
That said, the two storylines might come together in a court of law when the people trying to make this merger happen point out presidential tweets and statements on the campaign trail targeting CNN. Even if that's not the causal link here, that could be an issue in courts.
Yes, I am not a lawyer. I am not a judge. I have nothing to do with the ultimate decision that's going to be made about this merger. That said, one thing that we clearly saw in the immigration debate is that when the anti-immigration executive orders were put before courts in Hawaii and other places, judges said, absolutely not. We are not going to approve these immigration rules because they clearly are unconstitutional. The president has said in tweets that he's essentially executing a religious test, and that violates the First Amendment. Similarly, the president has directly said, essentially, I want to punish CNN, and that's why I'm going to block this merger. So I do think that the Justice Department could simultaneously, A, have a perfectly legitimate reason to block this merger, and B, be hamstrung by the fact that their boss, the president of the United States, has let slip a possible motive on the White House's department, on the White House's standpoint, that would cause a judge to say, we don't believe that this is about antitrust regulation. We believe this is about the President of the United States violating the First Amendment, trying to shut down speech, trying to punish freedom of the press by forcing the sale of CNN from Time Warner. It is absolutely possible to me, I think, that issue is going to come up in court.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Derek, this is the U.S. Department of Justice against two really big, well-known companies. In a legal sense, sparks are going to fly here, aren't they?
They are going to fly. And the last thing I'll say very quickly is that what AT&T and Time Warner are going to say is that they have to do this merger because big tech has gotten too big. And so in a strange way, even though this will be AT&T versus the federal government, the companies on trial ultimately might be Facebook, Google, and Netflix, those big tech companies who AT&T is going to argue are already becoming monopolistic. And so it requires quasi-monopolistic companies in order to fight them.
Derek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Derek Thompson, senior writer at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, labor markets, and the media. He joined us to look at the Trump administration effort to stop a merger between AT&T and Time Warner. Right now, have you ever wondered what it would be like to walk through your hometown 50 or 100 years ago? If so, you're not alone. Our next guest has turned that idea into a new book of photographs documenting the past and present of Chippewa Falls. By finding antique postcards and pairing them with pictures taken at the same locations today, the book lets readers see how things have changed or haven't changed around the city. You can see some of those pictures on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Tank is an award-winning photographer and author from Menominee and an emeritus faculty member at UW-Stout. His new book is Postcards from the Past, Then and Now Photographs of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. He'll launch the book at the Chippewa Falls Public Library on Thursday, November 30th at 6:30 p.m., David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, this is your latest book. You've done a series of Menominee, Eau Claire, Dunn County, and now Chippewa Falls. What got you interested in this basic concept, old photos and postcards, and matching them up to today?
I came across the picture of Menominee, and I'm going like, where in the world is this? It was an amazingly cool picture. And just out of my own curiosity, started snooping it out, and I do a lot of photography, and decided I'm going to take a then and now picture and see what compares. I started doing several of these, and the Dunn County News was interested in publishing some of them. And after about half a dozen or so, people started saying to me, hey, we're clipping those out and putting them in a notebook. You should make a book of those. Of course, I never imagined that I'd have enough. And the next thing I know, I had 50 pairs of them of Menominee and came up with the first book based on Menominee, and I've just continued on since then.
And once you pick a community, how do you track down these old postcards and pictures?
Most of the postcards I'm finding on eBay, there's not postcards of a community in that community, because when people have a postcard, they send it away. Some of them have come as far as Australia.
Wow. And when people hear about this, do they start digging into their old photo archives to give you some inspiration?
They do. And a lot of people say, hey, I've got a whole box of postcards. And then they find out they're from other places.
And I think of postcards, you know, it's the big tourist destinations that, you know, you go to New York or San Francisco or whatever. But it turns out a lot of smaller towns and cities had their own postcards in this era.
There were a ton of them, especially in several different eras. There were a lot of them from around the 1906s, 1907s, and there was another group around 1915. There was a bunch in the 1940s. And then a few in the 1960s. Now, postcards really have dropped off today, but most of them that I'm finding are, like you mentioned earlier, 50 to 100 years old.
Getting the photos and postcards has got to be just half the battle. Once you've got that image of, say, a downtown or a park in town, how do you start figuring out where it was and you try to capture the exact angle?
Right. Some of them I'm able to find where they were pretty obviously. You know, I might say it's a particular corner on a Barstow Street in Eau Claire or whatever, and I'll go there and check it out. But then the challenge becomes, how do I line up the pictures so they match exactly? A lot of the pictures of downtowns were taken from the middle of the street, and there wasn't as much traffic in 1915 as there is today. So that becomes somewhat of a challenge for me. The other thing is pictures that are of rivers, lakes. The amount of growth of trees is considerably more today. We always think that, gee, we have fewer trees today. Not true at all. There are so many more trees. And those trees are often in the way of me trying to take the picture.
How do you tackle that challenge you mentioned of that picture that was taken from the middle of the street, dashing in and out between traffic or what?
Well, yes, that. Sometimes I will go back on a day when there's not going to be much traffic. For instance, the Eau Claire pictures that are downtown, I shot most of those on the 4th of July when there wasn't very many people downtown. I also would go back maybe a Sunday morning. I had one shot in Menominee. I went very early on a Sunday morning. There was virtually no traffic there at all. So I'm standing in the street lining up my photo, and I see a pickup truck coming down towards me. The guy gets right next to me. He stops in the middle of the road and says, "What are you doing standing in the middle of the road taking pictures? You're blocking traffic." And I'm thinking, like, I'm just one guy standing here. You stopped your truck.
We're talking to David Tank. He's a photographer. His newest book is Postcards from the Past, Then and Now Photographs of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. And David, let's visit Chippewa Falls now. This is your latest project. How much has Chippewa Falls changed since the older postcards you looked at?
Chippewa Falls is really a fun community to shoot because they have a very strong historic sense up there. Even things that have changed, like new buildings in their downtown, they're reconstructing to fit in with the look of their older buildings. So that made it a lot of fun for me. And the people there were marvelous about helping me out. I had one picture. It's a shot that's a long shot over the river, over the dam, and the best I could figure out, it was taken on top of the roof of the Heide Center there, the Arts Center, Arts and Performing Arts Center. And much to my surprise, they offered to let me go up on the roof to reshoot the scene today. People have been marvelous up there for helping out with that.
Do you ever run into a situation where a shot was taken from the top of a tall building that isn't there anymore?
Oh, yeah. For instance, there's the courthouse in Chippewa Falls. There were several pictures that were taken from the cupola of the courthouse, and that's not an option for me anymore. There isn't a way that I can reshoot that.
What were some of the most fun ones in Chippewa Falls to find that angle and recreate?
Well, there were a lot of them that were a lot of fun. I think one of the most fun places, though, I had was there's Irvine Park, which is a beautiful old park, over 100 years old, and a lot of postcards were taken of that park when it was brand new back in like 1908, 1907. And reshooting those pictures today was a real fun project for me because not only did I get to shoot the pictures, but I got to spend the day in the park.
What kind of reaction do you get when you look at these pictures with people who live in these communities today?
A lot of reminiscing happening. People remember, oh, I remember when I went to that restaurant or that's where I did such and such. And sometimes when I'm taking pictures, people will come up to me and ask me, what are you doing? And I'll show them the card that I'm trying to recreate. And people will sometimes even give me memories just that way.
Is there a sense of loss at the buildings that aren't there anymore, or are people, you know, happy that they live in a place that's changing and growing over time?
It depends on the building. There was a building in Eau Claire that went down a couple of years ago to make way for a CVS store, and it was a building that looked like an old pagoda, a restaurant. And when I do my presentations about Eau Claire, I have that picture in there. And consistently, throughout about half dozen presentations, when I get to that photo, the audience boos.
We've talked about the Eau Claire Pagoda on this show before. This was a big deal there, I know, getting rid of that.
But it's really funny how the whole audience, just without booed. Any prompting, they just literally boo.
Wow. Well, now, do you try to match up the seasons to your postcards?
I do, but most of them have been taken in the summer. I've got a few that are winter, not many. What I do try to match up is the time of day, because that makes a big difference on shadows.
Now, this is your fourth book. What do you have new projects in mind? You've got, an endless list, all the towns and counties in Wisconsin.
I do. I'm working on a book from Fond du Lac, which is the town where I grew up. And I'm also have some interest from a person who grew up in Wisconsin Dells on working with me for a book from Wisconsin Dells, which should be a lot of fun.
And a lot of postcards out there from, I'm sure, Wisconsin Dells and Fond du Lac?
Yeah, Fond du Lac, I actually have the whole collection of postcards, and I have done most of the shooting already. And I thought I might get it done this past summer, but then I hurt my back and wasn't able to continue with the shooting. So that's going to be a next summer project now. Ironically, it wasn't that I grew up in Fond du Lac that got me started wanting to shoot that city. My wife and I were visiting Memphis about a year ago, and we were in an old architectural antique store looking at strange things, and the woman who owns it came up and said, "Are you interested in postcards? We just got a box in." Well, she didn't know what I was doing. We looked at the postcards. There were 40 postcards in there from Fond du Lac.
No way.
So I guess we're doing Fond du Lac next.
And any big surprise changes you see over the years? Obviously, the buildings, you mentioned more greenery. Anything else strike you for then and now?
Well, just the fact that some things, I can't imagine they used to fit there. There's one block in Chippewa Falls. It's now a grocery store, or it's actually a grocery store that's on the auction block this week, that fills almost the entire block. Originally, that block included the fire station, city hall, high school, an elementary school, the Carnegie Library, and a church, all on the same block. The church is still there. All the rest of them have been taken over by the grocery store and its parking lot. It's hard to imagine they all fit there. And I was really excited that I was able to get a postcard of each one of those buildings.
David, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
David Tank's new book is Postcards from the Past, Then and Now Photographs of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. To celebrate the launch of the book, he'll be at Chippewa Falls Public Library on Thursday, November 30th at 6:30 p.m. You can see some of those pictures on the Ideas Network Facebook page, by the way.
Your favorite music, well, it just makes you sad.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Listening to a certain song can give us chills, and music has been known to change our behavior, from helping cure insomnia to getting shoppers to spend more money at the mall. What about sad music? A recent study suggests that listening to sad songs causes the mind to wander, leading to self-reflection, which can ultimately help us feel better. And we've all turned to that sad song at a sad time, which for some reason seems to work. John Powell is a scientist and a musician. He holds a PhD in physics from Imperial College at London University and a master's degree in music from the University of Sheffield in Great Britain. He's the author of Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, hi, Rob. I'm glad to be on the show.
Well, before we get to the sad music part of it, remind us, we've talked to you about music and our emotions and our physiology before, but remind us of how powerful an effect music can have on the way we think and feel.
Well, music can affect us in loads of different ways, from loads of reasons. And if you ever watch a film without music, you'll find yourself being far less involved emotionally. In fact, music is one of the main emotional transmitters during a film. It really highlights all the effects that they try and give you visually. For example, it's very much easier to surprise somebody with the music rather than the imagery. So they often rely on that. And the really peculiar thing is that they can really heighten the emotion of an emotional climax of the film by playing the wrong music immediately beforehand. For example, if someone's looking for someone in the woods, and they're worried about where they are, and they play happy, jolly music, and then they find the person's in deep trouble, it's very much more shocking because you had the happy music beforehand. And if the reverse happens, if the person's looking for someone in the woods, and there's all gloomy and terrifying music playing in the background, when they actually find them and they're safe and well, you feel very much more relieved. And music without a film obviously has the same sort of effects on us. It can make us joyful, and as we'll come on to hear in a minute, there's a peculiar thing that happens with sad music.
Yeah, let's get into that. Some new research, but I guess in some ways it's not that surprising, given the existence of the blues, for example. Listening to sad music can actually do good things for us. Why?
Yeah. I mean, you have to bear in mind that all music, no matter what it's purported to give you emotionally, is designed to be pleasurable. So even sad music is designed to be pleasurable. If there really was genuine music around in the world that made you feel miserable, it would be very unpopular. So you wouldn't hear anything of it. But basically, music has lots of ways it stimulates your brain and lots of ways it captivates the pleasant side of our life. And so even sad music makes us smile, makes us happy. I mean, there's loads of stuff... The country and western stuff, the music generally isn't actually that sad, but the lyrics are very sad. You've got two things at play here. You've got the music going on and these sad lyrics underneath. So you might empathize with the singer who's got this dying dog, as they often have in country western, or a love affair gone wrong. And you might empathize with that, but you're not deeply involved yourself. There's a big difference between listening to happy music and sad music. The main thing is that when you listen to happy music, you recognize that the person that wrote it and performed it designed it to be happy. You recognize that fact. And also, you automatically get happy about it as well. You genuinely become happier. And you can measure the chemicals in your bloodstream, and you can see that serotonin is coming into play, and dopamine and so on, which means that you are genuinely getting happier. So these are real, genuine effects. When you hear sad music, something peculiar happens. You recognize that it's sad. You recognize that somebody wrote this and sang this with sadness in mind. But you don't get involved. You don't involve your own emotions in the sadness. You sort of observe it as a sad event or a sad description, but you keep your distance and you remain pleased by the music. And so, in fact, you end up being quite happy about the whole thing.
Okay, I'm thinking of what I hear about things like cognitive behavioral therapy, where people are trained to distance themselves from a compulsion or a trauma or things like that. I mean, is something similar going on? We're dealing with something like our emotions, but at a step removed, and that makes us feel better?
Yeah, it's very complicated, and they haven't actually got to the bottom of it. The psychologists involved in the research haven't really got to the bottom of why we enjoy sad music quite so much. There's lots of theories around. One of them is that, just like watching a sad play, what we can do is we can explore sadness in our lives without actually being exposed to genuine sadness. And we find that interesting and pleasurable in some way. So you're basically just having a look at this sad thing that's not happening to you. Don't think it's a thing where you see something bad happen to somebody else and think, I'm glad it isn't happening to me. But, you know, the Schadenfreude thing. But it's not that. Basically, what we're doing is experiencing some sort of sadness and playing with the sadness, but it actually doesn't make us sad at the same time.
We're talking to John Powell. He's the author of Why You Love Music, and we're talking about why we love sad music in particular, the emotional benefits of sad music. Is there something inherent in music that we know it's scientifically this is sad music, or is it culturally defined? Do we grow up reading things as sad?
Well, there are quite a few things that indicate to you whether the music is designed to be sad or not. As I say, you don't generally get sad with the music. You just recognize it as being sad. The main musical signal that gives you a clue as to what music is supposed to be doing is its speed. And you'll find that sad music is nearly always slow. Because if you speed up the music, even if you get a sad piece of music and speed it up, it sounds happier and happier. So the slowness is one thing. In the West, we are encultured to we hear major and minor keys. And even though if you're not a musician, you don't know, you couldn't describe what a major or minor key was, but we hear them all the time, and so we get used to the fact that this is a major or a minor key. So just like you can appreciate flowers without knowing what their names are. So you have major and minor keys, and minor keys are rather more complicated than major keys. And complicated emotions are generally, sad emotions are generally more complicated than happy emotions. I think it was Tolstoy that said, happy families are all happy the same way. Sad families are all miserable in their own particular way. So sadness tends to be a more complicated emotional response to what's going on. And the more complicated minor key seems to be suitable for that sort of thing.
In Spinal Tap, we heard that D minor was the saddest of all keys. Is there anything to that, or is there a scientifically sadder key?
Actually, peculiarly enough, I did the research on whether the named keys themselves have any differences to your response. And in fact, there's absolutely nothing in it. It's an old tale that has no truth in it. Basically, A minor is as sad as B minor is as sad as C minor, and A major is as happy as B major is as happy as C major. They're all the same. There is a difference between the minors and the majors, but picking one and saying this is more sad than that one is just madness. And I did some research on it, and we proved it categorically.
Well, you shared one of your favorite sad songs with us. I want to give a little listen to it and then talk to you about it a little.
Talk to me of Mendocino, close
Okay, so we've got the slow pace there, some sad lyrics, it sounds like. Tell us about this song a little bit. Talk to Me of Mendocino by Kate and Anna McGarrigle.
Well, it's a very well-written song. It's very beautiful. The words are very sad. This girl's got a love affair gone wrong in New York, or New York State, actually, she says. And she's harking back to Mendocino. And I've never been to Mendocino. I don't even know where it is. I think it's in California. I'm not sure. But you can empathize with her having this emotional turmoil, but obviously you're not involved, so you can sort of observe it without getting too sad about it yourself. But the music is just so beautiful, and their singing is incredible. Yeah, so basically, although the words transmit a story, the music is just a beautiful accompaniment, and so you can appreciate both things. I mean, we all appreciate sad stories. We watch films with sad parts in them, and some films are just sad all the way through, but that isn't generally the case. And the same with novels and stories, you know. It can't be happy all the time, so it's pleasant to explore sad stories.
And before I let you go, I want to ask about the role of memory and association in this, a random sad song versus one that we associate with a time or a moment in our lives.
Yeah, this is an odd thing, because you can actually get genuinely sad from a happy song if it evokes a memory of happier days. You know, if you've recently got divorced and then a song comes on the radio which was your tune, that can make you genuinely miserable, even though it could be a really happy tune. So one of the ways that music does evoke emotions in humans is from the relationship between your memories and what was happening at the time in the music. So music itself can evoke memories, but also the association with music can evoke emotions from that time.
We'll leave it there. John, thanks again for joining us.
No problem. Anytime.
That was scientist and musician John Powell. He's the author of Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. He joined us for a look at the science of sad songs. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy listening to sad music? What's your all-time favorite sad song? However you define that. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls and play some favorites in just a minute here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing with our sad song theme, and we're going to talk about our favorites now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. We just heard some of the science behind sad songs and why they can make us happy for some reason. What is your favorite sad song, and do you turn to sad or downbeat music when you're in a bad mood, or do you go for something happier to turn that frown upside down? Weigh in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Halima Shah joins us now. She's a Central Time producer and sad song aficionado. Hey, Halima.
Hey, Rob.
So do you turn to sad songs when you're in a down mood or a bad mood?
It actually has very little to do with my mood. I am generally just very into sad songs, and you can tell by the sound of my voice that I'm actually very joyful to be talking about this. I think there's just something about the catharsis that sad music gives you. There's not always time or ways to like articulate those really sad emotions. We don't really like to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, I listen to a lot of sad or dreary songs, and I don't always realize that they are. You know, sometimes I think, oh, this song would be great for bumper music on the show, and then I go to like record it, and I realize this is way too downbeat and depressing to put on the show. So, yeah, I don't even think about it. I just listen to it all the time.
No, you really don't think about it. And I think the other thing is that when you work in radio, everything like has a meaning. Every song you pick has to have something to do with the theme. When it comes to my own personal life, it doesn't matter if I had a good day. I just want to hear a sad song.
Well, we'll play a couple of our favorites in just a bit. But let's go to your calls right now. Randall is on the line in Manitowoc. Randall, hi.
Hi.
What's your sad song, Randall?
Well, the first one that came to mind is Lonely Street by Andy Williams.
And do you turn to this when you're feeling sad, or is this just a song you like any time?
I like it any time. I don't hear it much anymore.
And do you have it on something you can play at home, to CD, whatever?
No, actually, I don't. Maybe I'll get it.
I think that's a good idea. Randall, thanks so much for calling in and getting us started.
Thanks for that call, Randall. I think a lot of times that there are sad songs that just play in our mental soundtrack
that's
in the back of your head. I feel like that's where he might be, and I have songs like that too. Let's go next to Terry in Appleton. Terry, hi.
Hello.
What sad song do you like?
Behind the Sun by Eric Clapton, op album with the same name. It's not a real long song, but it's very touching.
Is there a special time or moment in your life that you associate with the song?
No.
When do you usually find yourself turning to it?
When I have that CD in.
Thanks a lot, Terry. Reason. Yeah, that works for me. Thanks so much, Terry. We have a couple of our songs, Halima, loaded up. Pick one of the ones you gave us to check out, one of your sad songs.
So one of my favorite sad songs is by Daniel Caesar. It is called We Find Love.
Let's give a listen. So you don't love me anymore, I think, has got to be the key sentiment of about 80 to 90% of all the sad songs out there.
It really is. And like, I don't feel like you need to go through a breakup to enjoy a breakup song. You just need to feel some kind of rejection at some point in your life.
Right. And it's kind of a, you know, take that too. Let's see how you like this song.
Yeah.
You're like me.
Yeah.
Check out my song.
If you're a little petty, like I can be sometimes. Sad music really does it for you.
Well, that fits the bill. Let's go back to our callers. Matthew is with us in Centuria. Matthew, hi.
Hi.
What do you got for us, Matthew?
Tom Trobert's Blues by Tom Waits.
Tom Waits, he can be real sad.
Oh, yeah, he can be very dark, but his lyrics are phenomenal.
Well, part of it's the delivery, too. Like, he can sell a lot of pain in his voice.
Oh, definitely. He's got the growl. I listen to it quite often, and as sad as it is, it does pick me up.
Matthew, thank you so much for sharing that. We are asking you to share your favorite sad songs at 800-642-1234. New research showing that sad music can actually help us feel better. And we just heard something about the science. We want your recommendations at 800-642-1234.
Now we'll go to Bill in Spooner. Bill, hi.
Hello.
What is your sad song?
Well, this is about a sad song. If you're of a certain age, you remember David Gates and Bread, and he had a number of maudlin hits. And I shared a house with three guys in college, and when one of them broke up with his girlfriend and was very depressed about it, we played David Gates relentlessly, just over and over and over again, and it made him really mad and throwing things and screaming at us. And we think that we helped him through a difficult period.
You think that? Wait a minute.
Yeah, what does your friend think?
Does he agree?
I don't know. I'll have to get in touch with him.
Yeah, you will.
By the end of the evening, we thought we cheered him up. He was yelling at us.
Okay.
Things were back to normal.
Well, in any case, I think Bill is really speaking my language here. There is nothing like a sad song after a breakup, and especially
when somebody else's breakup.
Yeah, but you know, when your friends try to make fun of you after a breakup, you're just mad at your friends. You don't have time to think about your own personal suffering. I think Bill did the right thing.
Friends make fun of you after a breakup. That actually reminds me of the line in Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, the old song, Now Laughing Friends Deride, Tears I Cannot Hide. Find some new friends. Break up with them. Back to your calls now. Tom is on the line in Waukesha. Tom, hi.
Hi.
What's your song, Tom?
Genius by Warren Zevon.
Oh, he had some sad ones. I don't think I don't know his catalog that well. What's that song about?
He talks about people who have managed to be genius in a certain way, but the lyrics aren't sad, but the music kind of is.
Interesting.
He's also got some other ones that he plays around with that same way. One of his earlier ones, Excitable Boy, is a happy little ditty about a murderer.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. Thanks a lot, Tom. Our science guest was talking about how when you contrast happy music, sad lyrics, or vice versa, that can really set things off a little bit.
And I think Tom made another important point there. Sometimes it's not always about the lyrics.
Right.
It's about the music itself. It's about this emotion it evokes in you, and you kind of assign that sad meaning to it if you want to.
I want to listen to one of the ones I set up. Again, I listen to a lot of dreary music. Here's one by Nine Inch Nails. Not one of the more rockin' ones. This is The Great Below. So I love this song. It's beautiful. I think it's about drowning, literally and metaphorically,
that's
kind of.
What it sounds
I'm
like.
Not really a lyrics guy, so it takes me like 50 times of listening to something like that.
How well can you swim, Rob?
You know, I could use some lessons. I drown pretty well. I swim pretty well. Or at least I can stay afloat anyway. But anyway, Nine Inch Nails is one of those really dark, kind of heavy things. I'm a pretty happy guy, but I love kind of dark, dreary, depressing music. I don't know where that comes from.
Absolutely. And I feel like you've called me zany before, and I'm very happy to talk about sad music. I don't think you have to be a sad person to enjoy sad music.
True. Well, let's get back to your calls now. Karen on the line in Grays Lake, Illinois. Karen, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Do you have a song or two for us?
I have two. The first is the saddest, and it's Jim Croce's Operator.
Oh, I know that one, yeah.
And the Beatles, Places I Remember. And that's not, we were saying it's really not sad as much as contemplative, because you could play it when you're just content with, you know, people that you want to be with. But the first one's definitely sad.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing those. And we'll go to Renee in Madison with a couple suggestions. Renee, hi.
Hi.
What songs do you have for us, Renee?
Well, I have two. One that I sort of just sing naturally, like when I'm doing the dishes and feeling down and stuff, is Making Believe by Emmylou Harris. Real break your heart stuff.
Okay.
And also, I love Alison Krauss's version of a Keith Whitley song, Ghost in This House.
All right. And you sing these while you're doing dishes in a bad mood. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's one of the things. And well, I sing all the time, but Alison Krauss's version, Keith Whitley's version of Ghost in This House was just super touching already, but she will just break your heart with that song. It's just beautiful. I mean, it's heart-wrenching, but beautiful at the same time.
Renee, thanks so much for sharing that. Thank you for all your calls. You can keep suggestions coming on the Central Time Facebook page. Halima, you were saying, we were saying before we started this, we kept thinking of more songs. Is there one you want to go back and listen to now after this conversation?
Oh, man, there's so many. I think every song that Frank Ocean has ever written, he is the king of writing sad songs. What about you?
I've got to go back and listen to a Black Heart Procession album that's just jam-packed with downers. Total downers. Hey, thanks to Carl Christensen, by the way, for loading actually a lot of music, more than we were able to use. Again, you can keep this sad song conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. The Thanksgiving Day celebration is mostly about food and sports, and this year, the magazine Sports Illustrated got into the food business with a top 10 power ranking of Thanksgiving foods, best to worst. The worst, I think we're probably all on the same page here, cranberry sauce. I agree with Sports Illustrated on this one. I can't really do much with that. I'll eat a little bit to be polite. I like cranberries in some forms. No offense to the many fine cranberry producers here in Wisconsin. The sauce, not a favorite part. Cranberry juice, I'll drink it all day, no problem. Number one on their list, the humble mashed potato. And they say, you know, do it straight. Don't get fancy. You don't need to do all sorts of stuff with garlic and cheese. Just straight up mashed potatoes with some butter. I could make a case for that. Now, here's kind of the shocker, sports fans. Turkey, right? The centerpiece of the Thanksgiving meal. Can't have Thanksgiving without the turkey unless you're vegetarian. And then they even try to have a fake turkey. Turkey number 8 out of 10 on the list. Dry, boring, people find, unless you really slather it in gravy. My secret is I do just turkey breasts. I don't try to cook a whole turkey because I know if I made a whole turkey, you wouldn't like it. It wouldn't be very good. That's the power rating list. We've put that, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. You can check out the whole list and weigh in with your thoughts while you're there. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.